Tuesday, the 11th of November, 1941. The Second World War had raged on for 2 long years, and Britain was losing the fight. Still reeling from the evacuation of Dunkirk, German troops were massed at the English Channel, poised to invade. And an 8-month blitz bombing campaign had reduced many cities to smoking and smouldering ruins of rubble. Hitler's plan was to pummel the British people into submission. Only it had failed. For most Londoners, the bombings had become a bit of a nuisance. Fires lit up every skyline. Guns were commonplace. And with each street tinged with the stench of rotting bodies, they carried on with life. That day was Armistice Day, later known as Remembrance Day and Veterans Day, where with fresh irony, the people marked the end of hostilities between the Allies and Germany just 23 years before. And with a paper poppy pinned to their lapels, at 11 a.m. sharp, the city would fall to a 2-minute silence. As a typical middle-class suburb in Chiswick, West London, Foster Road was full of neat semi-detached houses on a peaceful tree-lined street, where you rarely heard a sound above a softly spoken whisper. At 8:45 a.m, as per usual, 28-year-old Leslie Ernest Ludford left his home at 11 Foster Road. Dressed in a smart suit and clutching a briefcase, he worked as a solicitor dealing in divorces and conveyancing. This half-mile walk took twice as long. As being born with dwarfism, this diminutive man seemed even smaller, as a curvature of the spine had left him with a hunched back and propped up by a pair of crutches. To some, he may have stood out as weak, but his father always said it didn't stop him, as the only thing he couldn't do was run. Leslie was well respected, a keen player of the card game whist, and was chairman of the Brentford and Chiswick Junior Conservative Club on nearby Chiswick High Road. As he'd done so many times before, he turned onto Hadley Gardens, heading into Duke's Avenue. The street was typically quiet, with a few cars parked up and the milkman having done his round. Opposite 1-3 Hadley Gardens, Ada Dancy was selling poppies. Arthur Burgess and Matilda Mott were talking to her. Stanley Randall was in his bedroom, and Violet Pender was a few paces behind Leslie. Ada said, "I didn't appreciate the seriousness at the time." As Violet later agreed, "I didn't think it was real." As having had a gas attack drill just days before, they thought it was a practice for if and when the Germans invaded. But it was real, and Leslie knew it. From in front of a dark blue saloon, a tall, shadowy man raised a single-barreled shotgun to his shoulder, as its sights fixed squarely as the dwarf hobbled on wooden crutches. Stopping dead, with his eyes wide in terror, Leslie raised his hands and screamed, "Don't! Don't!" But the man showed no mercy. Exploding in a fiery burst, a 12-bore shell of lead shot ripped apart his upper left arm, shattering the humerus, embedding the flesh with red-hot wadding and fragments of his suit as it spun him like a child's toy. Collapsed and bleeding, as Leslie steadied himself on the wall, he screamed as a tall man in a grey suit, a grey overcoat and a grey hat reloaded the shotgun and stalked towards him, focused and calm. As death loomed, breathless and broken, Leslie hobbled to the side gate of 1-3 Hadley Gardens, but with it locked, as he turned, he saw that all that stood between living and dying was a man with a gun. The second shot blasted a 2-inch hole in his gut, shattering the wooden gate behind him and splattering blood and bits of his digested breakfast across the path as Leslie slumped to the ground. Only the grey man didn't want him scared or injured, but dead, as he fired again from just a few feet away. Crumbled in a bloody heap, the third shot blew a 4.5-inch hole from Leslie's groin to his belly button, lacerating his bladder, his intestines, his pelvis, parts of his spine, and with 3 gaping wounds to his torso, which had shredded his left lung. He was slowly drowning in his own blood, acids, and toxins. In panic, the poppy seller and 2 others hid inside of 15 Hadley Gardens. But being deaf and having not heard them, Violet Pender walked on. I hurried along the pavement, thinking I would get out of the way. And when I got outside the house, I heard another shot and felt a pain in my right thigh. Staggering to the junction of Duke's Avenue, passers-by dragged her into the surgery of Dr. Evans. And as the assailant's car roared down Foster Road, this unusually quiet street descended into screams. Ambulances arrived at 8:52 a.m., 2 minutes after the call. Violet was lucky, as although suffering wounds to her right thigh and buttocks, with no broken bones or severed arteries, just superficial cuts, she was bandaged, stitched, and later made a good recovery. But Leslie was ghostly pale by the time the doctor had arrived, having lost 2 pints of blood, which was a lot for his tiny frame. And although barely alive, it was as he was driven to West Middlesex Hospital that Sergeant Hammond saw his lips move and said,
I put my head down to him, raising it slightly from the stretcher, and I heard him say, Brent. It was Brent.
He then fell unconscious and died of his injuries. But who was Brent? The street was littered with evidence, as beside Leslie's scattered and bloodstained crutches, 5 empty shotgun shells were found with their tiny brass caps bearing the words Ely and Kinnick and 12 bore. But having been passed from person to person, any hope of finding a fingerprint was lost. The same was said of the killer's description, as although the police interviewed the 6 living witnesses, they could all remember the gun, the blasts and the fear, but not him. Said to be tall, of average build, and in his 20s or 30s, dressed in grey, with his face hidden by a grey trilby hat. He was a grey man in every sense of the word. He was forgettable, as all agreed.
I doubt I'd recognise him again.
What baffled the police was the lack of motive. Leslie's killing was deliberate, but why target him? By all accounts, Leslie was a pleasant man who lived a quiet life with no debts, enemies, or secrets. Being unmarried, he had no jealous lovers. Being a staunch conservative, he had no fascist leanings. Being a little dull, he played cards, but never for money. And given the era, he wasn't a suspected German spy or a British double agent, as owing to his disability, he was declared unfit to serve for his country. Violet's shooting seemed random, as she only knew Leslie by sight. She knew no one called Brent. And yet if he tried to kill her because she was a witness, why didn't he kill the others who were huddled inside a nearby house? What was certain was that Leslie's killing was targeted. And given his unique look, it wasn't a case of mistaken identity. With witnesses seeing a dark blue Hillman Minx parked up just minutes before, the killer had waited, targeted, and gunned Leslie down in cold blood. He knew where Leslie lived, and he knew his route and timings, having kept surveillance on him in the days and weeks prior. But who was Brent, and why did he want Leslie Ludford dead? A small clue was gleaned from the scene, as although terrified, Matilda had memorized the license plate of the car. GGC 83.
All cars, all cars. Be on the lookout for a dark blue Hillman...
At 9:10 precisely, as detectives started trawling every garage, showroom and hire company, its details were transmitted to every constable and wireless car in every borough. With the hunter now being the hunted, the police thought it was only a matter of time before Leslie's killer was caught and brought to justice. And yet before the police and ambulances had even arrived, the grey man had moved on to his next target. Five minutes west, having snuck along the back streets, at exactly 8:55 a.m., the dark blue Hillman Minx pulled into St. Mary's Grove, another quiet residential street where the middle classes live in silence. He didn't rush, he wasn't indecisive, and he wasn't prowling the streets looking for victims to kill. As having rehearsed this, he calmly pulled up outside of a two-story, semi-detached Victorian home at 1 St. Mary's Grove. This was the pleasant little home of two sisters. 58-year-old Annie New, a spinster who lived alone in the ground floor flat, and 56-year-old Emma Jane Crisp and her husband Thomas, who lived upstairs, with their flat a little bit quieter, as during the Blitz, their daughter Phyllis had been evacuated to the country. Just like Leslie, they seemed an unlikely target. And yet the grey man was specifically hunting them. Opposite, Mrs. Kimpton saw the car pull up. The grey man in the grey suit and hat get out. He walked up the path towards the door. He rang the bell and gave it three loud knocks. Inside, Annie went to answer it, but with her sister Emma saying,
"It's the milkman. I want to speak to him."
She beat it to the door. And when she opened it, no one was there. She looked, but the milkman was still a few houses away. And seeing a newspaper at her feet, it was as she bent down to pick it up that she spotted a man sitting in a car's back seat. With the shotgun's long barrel perched on the car's right rear window, from inside, the grey man fired. Exploding in red-hot fury, both sisters were shot with the first blast. Partially obscured by Emma, Annie was hit in the right forearm as lead shot ripped into the flesh, described as a sharp stinging pain. Emma had sustained the brunt of the double-barreled shotgun's brutal force, as with 117 wounds to her hand, abdomen and chest, her right kidney and liver were lacerated, her right lung collapsed, and leaving a 14-inch hole in her body. Blood flooded her pleural cavity as she cried,
"I've been shot!"
Staggering backwards, Annie tried to pull her sister away from the line of fire. But before she could, a second shot shredded Emma's left elbow, forearm and buttock, leaving 174 wounds and a 10-inch hole. And as calmly as he had arrived, the assailant got back into the driver's seat and drove away. Screaming for help, Mrs. Calcott called the police from her phone box, and they were there in minutes. Rushed to West Middlesex Hospital, where Leslie lay dying, Annie was permanently disabled, disfigured, and traumatized for life. But despite the surgeon's best efforts, Emma died at 5:25 a.m.